so thank you for coming. I'll be telling you about a very specific dark matter candidate. And thank you for coming, even if some of you probably have never heard of this. And so when people tell you they have a dark matter candidate, you should be asking yourself, okay, well, is this a good dark matter candidate? And by asking this question, you can actually split it in a few questions. You can say, okay, well, can it exist? And can it be stable? And if yes, then you should be wondering, well, could it be dark matter? Can it be all of it? Or if not, is it possible that it's a small portion, but we could still probe it and at least know what a small portion of dark matter is? So I'm not going to address the first question. Instead, I'll call it introduction to the sexual quirk. And I'll instead focus on the second part. And for this, I will be looking at the freeze-out, drag detection, accumulation, and annihilation. So that is my goal for today. So let's start with the introduction. The idea of the particle started in the 70s. Bob Jaffe at MIT, well, at the time he was more at Stanford, he was looking at bound state of six quarks and trying to compare them with the mass of two baryons using this MIT quark bag model. And he said, well, if I have a bound state of two up, two down, and two strange quarks, that thing has zero spin, that thing has zero charge, it might be stable. Stable in the sense of QCD, just that it can exist as a six quark bound state. And at the time, we didn't think of it as something that was long lived. It was just something that might be slightly more stable than having two lambda hyperons. And from this, people have tried to do some searches for this state. The initial estimate was about 2.1 GeV, and so many searches started looking for this, putting this cutoff at 2 GeVs, only looking for states that were heavier than this. And so you had different accelerators trying to produce it, people trying to make hypernuclei, so nuclei in which you convert one of the protons or neutrons into a lambda hyperon. Then you do that again, you add a second lambda hyperon and try to see, okay, well, do these two lambda hyperons coalesce and create this particle? And nobody has seen anything on the experimental side, and they were putting some cuts on whether this particle can exist or how frequently can we take two lambda hyperons and transform it into this particle. On the theory side, also maybe a bit more recent than the 80s, Lattice QCD has tried to do searches for this particle. So Lattice QCD, what they do is, in this case, they were looking at what is the binding energy of this particle, and they were comparing what would be the mass of this particle with the mass of two lambdas. And what they did is, Lattice QCD operates at these unphysical pion masses, so the Lattice QCD data are the little red points. And what they were finding is that at these unphysical pion masses, this particle seems to be bound. So the binding energy is above zero. But then people, they said, okay, well, the real pion mass is my dashed line over here. If you extrapolate these points to the physical pion mass, in pretty much all cases, this seems to be unbound. So it doesn't seem to be a particle that would like to be stable. So where does this leave us? From there was a claim in the past few years that instead of being a particle that resembles a bit more a kind of a deuteron, which is a not very tightly bound state of two lambda, that this particle might be a lot more bound. And by it being a lot more bound, its mass would be much smaller than the 2 GeVs that were the cuts that were put by experiments. And so it would avoid all these experimental bounds. And the claim is that even Lattice QCD could not see it. And the reason is that Lattice QCD, what they're seeing is they're seeing a tower of states. And the only way you know you have the ground state is by taking your time to infinity. But time in Lattice QCD is discrete, and they don't have enough computational data to go long enough in time to ensure they only see the ground state. They don't see an excited state, which would be maybe what they're seeing there. And so this idea of, well, maybe it's not excluded yet, came from Glenys Farrar in 2017. And she called this the stable sexo quirk. Now, initially, this call was the state was called the H. Diberion or H. Dihypron. The change from this name to the name sexo quirk came in part because between 1977 and 2017, the letter H was already taken by the Higgs. So we had to change letter, and Glennis chose the S. And here, this might be potentially more bound, and the mass range we're looking at is something that is more about 1.8 GeV rather than 2.1 GeV. So I will start from this and think of it, okay, well, as a dark matter candidate, how is this particle? So potentially we can have it as cold dark matter. It's neutral because of its quarks, doesn't have spin. And the mass range I'm going to be looking at is this 1.8 GeV. And this mass range is very specific, is that if it's too light, it's very easy for our nucleons to just decay into it by just changing some strange quarks. But if it's too heavy, it's very easy for this particle to decay into just protons, neutrons, and lambda hyperons.
So yeah, I probably missed. So why the mass has been revised to be lighter than
the initial estimate was using the MIT quark bag model, which is really something that you assume that you have some pressure shell and you see what is happening inside. It is an approximative method. Maybe that's correct, maybe that's not. Here it's only an argument of what is the mass that we would like it to have to be stable. There is no argument here as to how can we get this mass. So there, it's not coupled with another method that is trying to oppose the quark bag model and say, okay, well, using this method, we can get this mass. So far, there is no method that tells us that this mass can work.
I see. Yeah. So stable with respect to strong interactions or stable absolutely?
So if it would be stable, not absolutely, it would be long-lived enough that it can be dark matter. If you go slightly outside of this range, then you have something that is very long-lived, but not long-lived enough to be dark matter. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm going to be really restricting into this range.
What was the light mass end? I missed that. The 1860, it needs to be heavier than that as well.
Because otherwise you can have protons, neutrons converting into this particle too easily. Yeah. And then what I'm going to be focusing on is the last two points, is whether we can obtain the right abundance in the early universe and whether it has not already been excluded by experiments. And the claim that has been done in previous works, so I'm showing in the bottom a few works that have been looking at this particle before, is that if the coupling between this particle and baryons is much smaller than the expected scale of QCD, since this is a QCD bound state, you would originally assume that this coupling would be about the QCD scale. So if this thing is highly suppressed, it should be possible for this to be dark matter. So I'm going to be looking at this claim of having to be much smaller, trying to put some numbers onto this much smaller. So we have an idea, okay, what particle we're going to be looking at, and let's see if we can obtain it in the early universe. Because it's a QCD bound state made of quarks, we're going to be thinking of producing it at the same time as we would produce protons and neutrons. So we're going to be looking at the time that we go from our quarks and gluons and produce our hadrons, and we want to have produced it before nucleosynthesis. So we want to have produced it before we start producing helium and deuterium. And you're going to see that if we have not done that by then, the abundance of this particle would be so small that it would not even be reasonable. In the standard freeze out scenario, what you would have is that you would have this equilibrium abundance that would be decaying with time, so time runs to the right. And then you have this interaction happening between this particle and your other standard model particles. And as you increase it, you get a smaller and smaller yield. So you would say that, for example, you have a line over here, which is what is the expected dark matter abundance. But if you have a too strong interaction, then you actually underproduce dark matter. But in the case of the sexo quark, it's going to have a shape slightly different. And what we do is that we start by saying, okay, well, we know what is the baryon asymmetry, and we're just going to apply it also to the sexo quark. So we're going to assume that the sexo quark has the same formation process as protons, neutrons, which is just that we start from our quarks and gluons, and we coalesce those into protons, neutrons, but also the sexo quark. So at early times, what we have is that everything just decays exponentially because of this exponential of the mass. And chemical potential at this point is very negligible. The proton and neutron lines are actually superimposed at this time because the difference in mass is extremely small. But then what happens at about 45 MeV is that the chemical potential starts being important. And this leads to a few different effects. For the proton and neutron, it leads to their stabilization to the yield that we see about today. And then at this point, they're going to start doing their nucleosynthesis. Our lambda hyperon is going to get a second period of decay. And the dashed line represents the anti-particles. And our sexo quark actually gets a period where it can stabilize and either increase if its mass is slightly less than twice the mass of a proton, or keep decreasing if its mass is slightly above. So when I was saying I'm looking at this range, 1860 to 1890, it's slightly above or below the mass of two protons, and it's going to have this strange behavior. So when I was talking about freeze-out, we have this nice exponential decay. The sexo quark has this at early times, but if our freeze-out happens a bit later, we actually have something that's going to be different than the standard freeze-out scenario. Last thing I want to say about this is this thick black line is the expected dark matter abundance. So the only way I would be able to get sexo quark as all of dark matter is if the freeze out really happens very early on in time. If I'm freezing out later, I can't freeze out later than one MeV because I would affect nucleosynthesis. So I really need to freeze out early, otherwise it doesn't work. So the freeze out actually has three reactions that we need to consider. The first one is the standard reaction, where we have our sexo quark interacting with anti-sexo quarks and into some light standard model particles. But we need to add to this a few more interactions just because we have a particle that is a QCD bound state. It's going to have two extra things. One of them is that I've been calling it the breakup rate. So we have a sexo quark with the help of one or two light pions or kaons can actually separate into two baryons. And in the second case, we can have the sexo quark interacting with an anti-baryon and giving us another baryon, also with the help of some pion or other light states to help us. And in this case, I'm going to be parameterizing these two interactions by a dimensionless number, which I call A or B, times the inverse pion mass square, which is about the scale I would be expecting if this was really just QCD. And this parameter A or B, I'm going to be scaling them between 1 and very small numbers and see what happens to my freeze out. So if I go back to my equilibrium abundance for my sexo quark, I had this line over here. And right now, I just want to show you what happens for the sexo quark. I'll do the anti-sexo quark afterwards, but it's much simpler. So if I take a very small value of A, 10 to minus 17, I'm getting something that is very close to the expected abundance, which means that I want something like 10 to minus 17.5. Now, I want to show you what happens if I increase this value. So I increase by one order of magnitude. I'm going down. And again, the width of each of these bands is really for the difference in masses that I'm considering. And I keep going. And now what you're seeing is that I'm getting even closer to the point where my chemical potentials start being important. And what I'm going to do is, instead of increasing by one order of magnitude, I'm going to increase by 15. And you're going to see barely any difference in the overall abundance that I'm getting for this particle. The freeze-out really happens in this flat region, but whether it freezes here or a bit later really doesn't make a big difference. Now, this is kind of the usual plot. I like to see this in a different way. I like to look at what is this final number divided by the expected dark matter abundance, because I think it's much much easier to see actually what's happening. And so I did this, now both for sexo quarks and anti-sexo quark. And what it gives me is that at early times, if I'm freezing out before chemical potential becomes important, I have this very straight line that happens here. So I can get all of dark matter, but if I really tune down this parameter A, then I can even get too much. We don't want that. And then there is this point here where our chemical potentials would become important. So I remove fully my anti-sexo quarks, and then I have this really, this very strong plateau happening over there. Now,
sorry, one question here. Yeah. You're including this process, like interactions with the pions, but before you also had the annihilation.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to show them separately. I'm not going to show all of them to you just because it's redundant. They're going to have pretty much the same shape. But yeah, I studied them separately. I studied them together. It's pretty much as we would expect, just adding two processes. Yeah. And then this plot is something that Colben Turner, not in the book, in a recent article did. But they only went up to like 10 to minus 8. And so they just said, well, there's no way that these particles can be all of dark matter. So what we're trying to show is that, well, yes, but you really need to tune down this parameter. And the other claim was that Glennis was saying that this parameter A has to be about 10 to the minus 12 to get all of dark matter. And what we're finding is that it has to be much smaller than that. And so we did this for this process, just because for completion, we did other processes. I'm just going to show you the other strong interaction process. Very similar. The difference between the different masses I was looking at is a bit less. So we see that these the region is a bit thinner. But once again, we have a crossing that so we can get all of dark matter for a very small value of B, and we have a plateau at a very small value of the abundance. So just to summarize the freeze-out, I'm not going to show you all the possible plots, is that for all possible interactions that we looked at, so we have three interactions. One is strong, but two are strong, and one of them is particle-antiparticle. We can get all of the dark matter abundance. But this gives us a symmetric population between sexo quarks and anti-sexo quarks. And this is something that people had not done before. People had never looked at anti-sexo quarks. Like, nowhere in the literature you have the word anti-sexo quark. And we tried to actually understand a bit, well, if we have these anti-sexo quarks, what can we do afterwards with those? Next is that if we want to get all of this dark matter abundance, you need a very strong suppression of one or two of these strong processes. So we will need to figure out what a mechanism to do this. We will need to understand how can something we expect to be QCD scale, so A and B to be one, how can we tune them down to be this small? The next point is if these values of A and B are even smaller than the ones I was showing you, we would not even equilibrate with protons and neutrons or any other QCD state. So we would need to find another way to obtain the freeze out if all of these rates are really highly suppressed. And finally, if we just take the expected QCD scale for these processes, we would get that sexo quark would be really a very tiny portion of all of dark matter. So the next thing I want to tell you a bit, yes.
Yes, question. So here you're assuming the SS bar process is turned off?
In this plot that I'm showing you here, yes. You can turn it off or you can just put it at a very small value, like 10 to the minus 35. So the usual thermal scenario would be 10 to minus 26. As soon as I tune it down by about 10 orders of magnitude, it's really as if it was zero.
Okay, so there's really like a third axis to this plot, which is also the size.
Yes. It's just impossible to show. yes.
Okay. I just wanted to know if so far I know like the number of the top of my head that for GEV kind of particles that result, then the annihilation needs to be p-channel, otherwise the model is excluded from indirect detection.
Yeah.
You are very close because it's like 1.8 GeVs, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it, is this S-channel or p-channel annihilation?
It should be S.
Okay.
And yes, so if you assume indeed that you have this 10 to minus 26 thermal freeze-out, then yes, you do have very strong constraints on that. I'm going to be also looking at constraints on A and B. So what I'm saying is that if for some reason this SS bar reaction is tuned down a lot, then we don't have these constraints. And then I want to see what happens on these two.
I see. Sorry. Okay. So it's another
free part. Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So as I understand in the dissociation processes, like you put like this strong interaction process, but like that would non-normalizable QED interaction play any relevant role? I guess that this object has some magnetic moment or something like that.
Yeah, so it doesn't have spin. So the magnetic moment should be zero. What I'll be talking about is the polarizability, which is the next order interaction. But we did not try to explain why A and B should be small. We just tried to see how much could we probe it.
Okay, I see, thanks.
Yeah, I think trying to calculate those would be really like a QCD calculation and not a dark matter calculation. So we hope that some people are going to be interested in doing some complicated QCD calculations from this. Okay, for drug detection, so I mentioned polarizability. This is one of the processes that should be an interaction between this particle and any standard model particle that in this case would have a charge or a magnetic moment or anything. But we should also expect that this particle interacts strongly. And the possibility is because of its quantum numbers is not a single pion exchange, but it can do double pion exchange, or it can do vector meson exchange, so like a W or phi. Now, I'm going to be talking about the polarizability, but we should take this as a lower bound on the full cross-section between this particle and standard model particles. We shouldn't take it that this is the full cross-section. And so we have some information from Lattice QCD that the polarizability of this particle should be approximately similar to that of neutrons. Now, because we have some claims that maybe Lattice QCD is not quite seeing the right state, we decided to investigate between 10% of the value of the neutron polarizability up to that value and see what do we get from this.
So, but why do you need to do polarizability? Why don't can you do just like a standard WIMP search? Because this is a WIMP, essentially.
Yeah. So in this case, we tried to justify using a specific value of the cross-section. By saying polarizability, what I mean is I'm trying to justify how it can give energy to a particle in your detector. Yeah. On the right hand side, I'm showing you the equation for this polarizability scattering cross section, and on the left, I'm showing you what is the parameter space of mass between 0.1 to 10 GeVs. So my particle is at 2, so just above the 1. And for this, I'm showing really that experiments all have a ceiling, and this ceiling is really due that if you have your dark matter particles that are coming in, they can scatter on different atoms in your atmosphere and the crust. And so by the time they reach your underground detector, they might not have enough energy to give it to your detector. So all of these experiments have a ceiling, which is not necessarily coded in their experimental data. So you have to go around and calculate it by yourself. Those are estimates. You can do different methods to estimate the ceiling. There's many different ways by now. But this is just to get an idea that all the parameter space seems to be excluded for this particle for scattering. So if we think about the QCD scale scattering, then really it's ruled out. And this is pretty much ruled out until 10 to minus 40. So just naively taking the value of the polarizability would give us something in this region. So between 10 to minus 30 and 10 to minus 32. And I'm showing it for different materials because it really has an effect in the equation for the scattering cross-section. And so what this seems to tell us is, okay, well, maybe if this value of the polarizability is correct, or this range at least, it seems to fully exclude this particle as being all of dark matter. But as the question at the beginning that I was trying to, to say for why I want to investigate this particle is, could this particle be a small fraction of the dark matter? And I investigated small fractions for freeze-out, so let's see what happens for small fractions using direct detection. When we think about small fractions, what happens is that the lower boundary of my experiments moves up proportional to this fraction, but the ceiling also moves down because the number of dark matter particles that may be able to arrive during the lifetime of your experiment is actually smaller. And so here I'm showing 10 to the minus 3 of dark matter. Yes?
I'm a bit confused about the previous plot, because if this is produced by a freeze-out, I will naively expect that you have a prediction for the place where the direct detection should happen if it's 100% of dark matter.
So freeze-out is an annihilation cross-section. So it's a number changing. Yeah.
You turn around and back, right? So that's what we do all the time, right?
Yeah. So in this polarizability, in the way that it's done with lattice QCD, it's a low energy effective interaction, which is not renormalizable. So I can't go from annihilation cross section to a scattering cross section, which is a bit annoying. I would like to, but that process doesn't allow me for that.
But is that a computational limitation, or is it like something fundamental that really, for this particular?
I would say it's a computational limitation.
Okay.
Yeah. And this is why, after this slide, I'm going to just be considering the full range of scattering cross section between like this 10 minus 26 to 10 to the minus 40, and just see if the total scattering cross section is in this range, what happens? Yeah. Just because we are not sure about this value of lattice QCD. Yeah. So the same way that I was kind of agnostic in the annihilation rates, I'm going to try to be agnostic in this scattering cross-section. The point I wanted to bring with this is that if the polarizability cross-section is the leading cross-section, then as soon as I go down to something a bit smaller than 10 to minus 3, I really have a gap opening right here above. And so it doesn't seem that direct detection can help us probe a subcomponent of dark matter that is composed of sexo quarks. So we have to find other ways to look for these particles if they are part of dark matter.
That's a good question. Like, so once you assume like a polarizability, in principle, like you have a minimum on like how much you interact with the pi zero. Like, what is that rate? Like, is it like going to be satisfying like your A equal to?
So you, what do you mean interact with pi zero?
Like just like I have a pi zero going
yeah.
to photon.
Yes.
The photon gets connected to your state.
Yeah.
And another photon coming out, that would be a diagram, right? Like how
yeah, yeah.
With the polarizability that you assume, like how large would be that cross section?
I don't know.
That you should be able to.
Yeah. That should be easy to compute. Yeah. The question is whether that would be larger than
A and B you are assuming earlier.
A and B are?
The A and B parameters you are assuming.
Yeah.
Right, like it's something like how much.
I did not take them into account. This is just scattering, assuming I know this polarizability.
I think what Kurt is saying is that like you could convert this to like a minimum value you'd expect for A and B though.
Potentially, the thing is that because this polarizability we have is really non-renormalizable, it's kind of annoying to go from one framework to the other.
You mean for a pi zero scattering?
I don't know. Maybe that's fine. That's fine. I have to check. Okay, so if we have a small fraction of dark matter that is composed of Sachse quark, one thing we can do is maybe look if they can accumulate, in which case, even if we have a small fraction, if we can reach a large density, then we can compensate in this way. And the usual way that we do accumulation is we take the, well, we just integrate in time, knowing that we have some fraction of these particles that are coming in the Earth, and they're being captured, but we are losing some because if they can evaporate, if they have the right velocity in the right direction, and they can escape the gravitational potential, but we're also going to lose some because they can annihilate with Sachse quark can annihilate with anti-Sachse quark, but the anti-Sachse quark can also annihilate with any proton or neutron they can see around them. So this can lead to a pretty large depletion of our anti-Sachse quarks. But first, if we don't have any annihilation, something we would find is something like this. So at a mass of almost 2 GeVs, and for quite a wide range of scattering cross sections, this would lead to an enhancement that would be 10 to the 14 particles per centimeter cube. That is, if they're all of dark matter. Then, if they're a small fraction, then you just decrease this number by the fraction of dark matter that they are. But once we start introducing annihilation, for our anti-Sachse quark is going to have a pretty big effect. So I'm just going to focus on the case that I don't have a big Sachse quark anti-Sachse quark reaction. I'm just going to look at what happens if I have the process, the strong annihilation process. And the way I want to do this is, instead of having a diagram, which is the usual, we have the mass and we have the scattering cross section, because in this case we are looking at a very specific mass or tiny mass range, but the mass is really not going to have a big difference in this case, I'm going to look at it in terms of my annihilation rate that I parameterize by B and the scattering cross section. And the lines that I have that are vertical indicate if my Sachse quark are all of dark matter, 10 to minus 3, minus 6, minus 9. And so this plot shows me how much Sachse quark I would have. And for a Sachse quark, the only way that this B appears is in this factor of FS, so how many am I capturing of these particles. For the anti-Sachse quarks, it's not as interesting because now I'm capturing a small number, but I'm also decreasing it because I can annihilate it with any nucleon I find around. But we decided to also look at what happens if my value of B is very small. So what I was saying before is that if B is smaller than, if A or B is smaller than some number, then I never have a moment that this is in equilibrium with protons and neutrons. But we still decided to see what happens in this case, in case it's a process that we haven't yet heard of. And so here I'm just going to assume that Sachse quark and anti-Sachse quark are each about half of the dark matter and see what happens. So for my Sachse quark, it's nothing happens. I really have just flat lines, and this is because, well, now this is a constant, so there's nothing happening. But for my anti-Sachse quark, it can still annihilate with any nucleon that it finds. So this number is still going to be varying on this value of B. And what we find is that we can get a pretty big accumulation. And if I tune this down to 10 to minus 27, then I'm going to retrieve something that looks like the left-hand side. So I can get a small enough value of this annihilation rate that it's as if none of these dark matter particles were interacting with nucleons. And so we studied this also for the other cross-section, but I don't want to show you too many diagrams that are kind of hard to read, so I'm just going to move on to...
May I ask, like, yes. How does this show up? Like, does this show up in SuperK?
That's where I'm going to go, yes. So my next point is, how do we discover an overabundance of thermalized dark matter? And there's two ways you can do this, but since you mentioned super K, I'm going to start from the second. So you're going to try to look for it annihilating. And when I say we have this thermalized dark matter, so we can't see it directly in detectors because it's too slow. So we can either look for it annihilating, and when it annihilates, it gives energy due to its mass, so we're fine. Or we can try to give it some more energy. But what you're trying to say is something like this. So we can either try to annihilate it directly in super K and look for this signal, or we can try to annihilate it anywhere in the Earth or around the Earth and then look for neutrinos that will be produced from this annihilation. So it depends on what is the process of this annihilation and what you're trying to see in your detector. Another thing that people have done is try to say, okay, well, this mostly works for heavier dark matter, something like 10 GeV and above. In those cases, the dark matter is going to try to sink to the center of the Earth. So the radial distribution is really going to be much greater at the core. And because of that, if you have an annihilation happening in the core, you can compare that with how much we would expect from heating from the usual fusion reactions, and compare that with how much heating you would get from these annihilation. So in the case of the Sexoquark, we focused on, I'm going to show you upscattering from previous work, but I'm going to be focusing on these two. But I'm only going to show you the last one, and the reason is that this one is 7 orders of magnitude smaller. You get a bit of enhancement because the Earth is much bigger than the size of your detector, but you lose from the fact that you have a factor of the scattering rate of neutrinos rather than the scattering rate of this particle, and it's much smaller. So overall, you lose a factor of 7 orders of magnitude. So I'm not going to show you, but if you want to see, I can show you afterwards. But first, I want to tell you a little bit about upscattering. This was kind of a wacky idea. There happens to be accelerators located in Gran Sasso, but also other labs underground. They're used for nuclear physics experiments. They have these beams, and they have these target stations, and they just shoot energies between 400 keV to 3.5 MeV. And have pretty decent currents, and they can have like running times nonstop for a pretty long time, at least 30 days in the literature we saw. And so we have these particles in those beam pipes. But then if dark matter is thermalized, we actually expect that in these beam pipes we should have some dark matter particles. And so what happens is that we have a beam. In this case, I'm going to take a proton, which can just hit a dark matter particle. And then if you put your detector close by, you can hope to upscatter some of these dark matter particles to a reasonable speed that they can give a little hit to your nucleus. So if you ask any experimentalist, they're going to say, backgrounds. And so even with a bit of shielding, because the issue here would be neutrons, we actually found that the numbers are not too bad. We put a very tiny shielding, and for very tiny shielding, we find that we can have a rate of like 10 to the 4 particles per second. Now, you add to this a reasonable shielding, and you lower this by a few orders of magnitude. But still, it doesn't look too bad. So if maybe eventually someone is going to try to, take those accelerators, because, for example, in Gran Sasso, the Luna accelerator is pointing away from xenon 1-ton, but if you could just like turn it around and do this for us, that would be amazing. So this was just an idea that we had. This is imagining we have like just a 10 centimeter detector. So if we have something much bigger than and with good shielding, hopefully we can get some good information. But what I want to focus on really is annihilation. So annihilation is going to come back to our processes, mostly B, but we can also look at it for the SS bar process. And indeed, the idea is Super Kamikaze. And if you don't know why we want to use Super Kamikaze, it has been there for a long time. It's been like continuously taking data for quite a while. It had a huge volume. We see a little platform with people standing there, and you don't even see the full detector. It's pretty easy to find a signature of a sexo quark annihilating with a nucleon, because usually the analysis that they're doing has these plots in the invariant mass and momentum. And we can use analysis such as nucleon decay or neutron oscillations and just look a bit further in the invariant mass, and it should be there. So people have not put cuts to remove those events. They've only put lower cuts, but never cuts above. So if an event like this happens, we were told that it would be reconstructed, or it would be tagged, and at least 50% chance it would be reconstructed and be in their data. So this would be a pretty easy search to do. And so we looked at two things. We looked at anti-sexo quark from the wind and anti-sexo quark that would be accumulated. So for the wind, we have at high scattering cross-section, we don't have any events, and this is because our sexo quark come, they scatter around, and then they lose energy, and then you don't consider them to be wind anymore. And what we see is that at the thick black line, which is my sexo quarks are all of dark matter, I get more than 10 to the 12 events over the lifetime of Super Chemokande. So this is another way that we can try to see, this particle is ruled out, assuming this cross-section is smaller than 10 to the minus 29, the scattered cross-section. But this can also tell us that even if I go to something that is closer to 1, which means I have my dark matter is more like 10 to the minus 11, but my sexo quarks are more like 10 to the minus 11 of all of dark matter, I can still probe almost all the way to 10 to the minus 8. But we also decided to look what happens to the left, and then you can also go pretty far. 10 to minus 27 is approximately where this stops being being possible to probe your anti-sexo quark using this method. But you can still get a pretty large rate of events. Now, for accumulation, accumulation doesn't have this issue at large cross-sections. And so we can also probe these high cross-sections, but we can't probe the low cross-sections. And the reason that we can probe these very small cross-sections is that now the size of the Earth is comparable to the... is comparable or smaller than the mean free path of your dark matter. So it would just cross the Earth without scattering a single time, and so it would not even be able to accumulate. And in this case also, we can probe almost to 10 to the minus 8 on the right-hand side. And to the left, I'm not going to tell you this number, but I'm going to tell you this one. I can go to like 10 to minus 34. So I can probe a pretty wide range of cross-sections. So I'm going to give you two summaries. One is in word, the other one is in picture. The first one is from the freeze-out, we can get all of dark matter. Well, we can get sexo quarks as all of dark matter, but it requires a very early freeze-out. And we would get a symmetric sexo quark, anti-sexo quark population. Now, with this anti-sexo quark population, we can actually probe it using annihilation in Super Chemokande. But if we want to have this non-negligible fraction of dark matter, you need to tune down all of these rates that should be QCD scale to a very small number. And the question is, how can we do this? Because it doesn't seem to be doable just with QCD. Drug detection is telling us that, it seems to be telling us that we can exclude sexo quark as all of dark matter, but it can't really tell us much about the subcomponent because it pretty quickly these boundaries are moving up and down at the same time. And so my second way that I want to give you this summary is taking my plot of the freeze out as a function of B. And then as soon as I hit about 10 to minus 16, and I'm going to go on the other axis, which assumes that an unknown process generates my dark matter abundance. And in this case, cosmology tells us that it can't be greater than one. Drug detection tells us that until about 10 to minus 33, it seems to be ruled out. Super chemokande tells us that it has to be greater than about 10 to minus 8 or smaller than 10 to minus 33, unless the cross-section is very large. In that case, you can go to 10 to minus 43. And so if you can have, it seems to have two possible solutions. One is we don't need any suppression relative to the QCD scale, and we just have to assume that sexocord cannot be more than about 10 to the minus 11 of all of dark matter. The other solution is you try to give me a reason that something that should be one is suppressed by more than 33 orders of magnitude, but you need to also suppress the other QCD cross-section by at least 17 orders of magnitude. So if you can do this and show, then in this case, you can have this as dark matter. But otherwise, I think that the case is a bit close for this particle. Thank you.
Questions?
So any ideas how this A can be so strongly suppressed?
The initial idea to suppress it by 12 orders of magnitude from Glennis is that the spatial extent of this particle is very small because it doesn't have a pion cloud. And because of that, she says, well, if you just think about quantum mechanics, the overlap of the wave function of this particle versus two baryons should have a high suppression, just spatially. Let's say that this works for 10 to minus 12. I don't know how you can keep going down. And the question is, do you need new physics, or do we not understand QCD?
Because this is also additionally assuming that you got rid of SS bar annihilation as well, right?
I need to tune it down, yeah. But it's also very strongly bound by super chemokande. I just didn't show it there. Yeah.
But that's like pure QCD, right? That's just SS bar goes to nucleons. So, yeah, it's difficult to understand how you can get it that small.
What does Glennis say?
Sorry?
What does Glennis say?
There's many experiments, there are detection experiments that she doesn't believe their limits. So there are some things that, especially the one that I can go back to the.
Let's check the speaker.
All right, yeah.